I find it, whenever Carmen comes up here and talks about the different mission trips, I get lost because there's something about hearing. You know, there's a bunch of kids who are 14, 15, raising $3,000, taking their spring break to go out and help people, to learn how to be water carriers. That story is, yeah, that's inspiring. And today, funny, I'm talking about how stories inspire us. Well, this last year I spent a lot of time in a counselor's chair. I always thought they had those, like, you know, on TV, they have the lay down ones where you sit there and, no, they have chairs. And I spent a lot of time in one. And a couple weeks ago, I actually had my counselor here, Dana. Some of you maybe were here, you met her. And I remember I was sitting in her office at one point, and I just realized that I was an island. And so if you guys don't know that terminology, the last series we did, Sabotage, go back and listen to it. It'll explain kind of the language I'm using. But essentially, it means that I normalized neglect in my life. And at some point, I just kind of stopped being open with people. Kind of pushed them away. And I wanted to connect with people, but I had this kind of like barrier between me and them. My glasses were part of that. Today, it's not because of that. It's just I didn't sleep a lot last night, so I was hiding the bags under my eyes. It's kind of a nice option. So I'm sitting in my counselor in Dana's office, and I'm going, this isn't working. The way I'm living my life isn't getting me where I want to be. And so I said, Dana, is it even possible to stop being an island? Like to learn to be secure, to open myself up to people? Is that even possible? I'm 41. I've been doing this for 41 years. You know, can't teach old dog new tricks. I am the old dog in this story. And I remember it was a really dark moment for me. Probably because my personality rarely feels hopeless. I'm always optimistic. It's like, you can do it. You know, everyone, all the people I know, I'm like, yeah, you can do that. But this moment I'm looking at her going, I don't think I can do this. And I remember she says to me, she's like, of course you can, Vince. And all of you who know my counselor, you know she's all optimistic. And all I heard was, whatever. You're going to say whatever you want me to say, right? Or what you think you want or I want you to say. That's what you're going to say to me. So she says, you can do it, Vince. And I was like, I just blew it off. And then she did something else. Something that fundamentally changed me. This last year has looked completely different because of this moment. She started telling stories of people just like me. People who had grown up islands, who'd been islands their whole life, who'd normalized neglect. But the difference is these people learned a different way of being. They had actually done the very thing I wanted to do, the very thing I needed to do. That changed everything for me. And the reason is because at some point as she told these stories, the stories became my stories. She talked about people, and in my head, it was me. They can do it. I can do it. I could see myself living a new way. And it gave me hope. I think that's the power of story. It can give us hope when we're hopeless. And it can do us by telling about people like us in our situation who've overcome, or who succeeded, who found love, who healed, who thrived. Think about it. Romantic comedies. If the person, you know, in this crazy romantic comedy situation can find love, surely we can too, right? They only had to scale a mountain to do it. It was easy. When I hear people, regular people, climbing Everest, I'm going, wow. I might be old, but maybe there's more I can do in this world. When I hear people with B averages who get into Harvard, small business owners who've been becoming like Bill Gates. These stories, we look at them and we go, maybe there's something more. We start to hope for something a little bit more. I think a lot of the reasons why the stories were written down in the Bible is for this very reason. Because we feel this sense of wanting to connect with God or to have some spirituality or more than in our lives. But we're going, I don't even know if I can get this done. Then we read stories of people just as screwed up as we are, sometimes a lot more. And they have these amazing God moments, and we go, maybe. Maybe that could be me. So today I want to share one of those stories. I hope it's going to be a story that's going to create hope in you. Because I think they wrote it down for that very reason. So last week, Jeff talked about a story of God calling Moses to save the nation of Israel. They were in slavery in Egypt in this story. And Jeff had you reflect on the story through the lens of shame. He suggested that Moses felt shame when God called him to do something great. A shame that many of us feel. A shame that keeps us from many things in our lives. Most of them are good. But today I want to talk about the next thing that happened. Because right after Moses hears from God in the burning bush, something strange happens. That just sounded weird, didn't it? God talking from a burning bush, and then there's something stranger than that. I study the Bible a lot. It starts to get normalized after a while. So stranger than that. Moses says this to God. He says, if I go back to the Israelites and tell them what you've told me, why will they believe me? And I think to make sense of this, I think it's important to retell the founding story of the Moses character. Because where we first meet him, I think we meet him as a traitor. Or at least, I think that's probably how it felt. So let me explain how it came about. Even when Moses was a young boy, he knew he was different. He wasn't like the other kids. He hung out with the Egyptians, but the fellow Egyptians wouldn't let him forget that he was actually a child of a slave. And no matter how hard the princess, his adopted mother, tried, she couldn't keep the cutting words of those kids on the playground from saying, "You're not one of us." When he'd go and play with the Israelite kids, he didn't look right with them either. He dressed nicer than them, had more to eat, better toys, and they didn't like it. In fact, some of them even hated him. Traitor. So Moses, I'm guessing, grew up as an outsider to everybody. An adopted slave to the Egyptians, a traitor to his people. And it wasn't his fault. He didn't do this. It's not like he picked his parents to be slaves in Israel and, you know, all this stuff. It's not what he wanted. And yet, as he grew up, no one forgot that he was an adopted slave of the princess of Egypt. People didn't trust him. They feared him. Even worse, they hated him. So he was a traitor to his own people. But not as an Egyptian. He stands before God, who speaks from a bush that's on fire but doesn't burn, and he hears God say this: "The Israelite cry for help has come to me, and I've seen for myself how cruelly they're being treated by the Egyptians. It's time for you to go back. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the people of Israel, out of Egypt." And so Moses is in a unique position. He's called by God to do the very thing that he's not really able to do. To go champion to the person who thinks he's a traitor, to save the people who also think he's a traitor. So when he asks God, and it's funny how he asks him, he says, "When the Israelites, your people, not mine, when the Israelites ask, what's the name, what's your name? How are they going to know that you're God and you're talking to me? What should I tell them?" And God answers them with what's often called the name of God. The name of God is actually a really funny thing because we don't actually know what it is or what it means or how to translate it. If you look on that, see the ark right over there? Top left, See that? That's the name of God right there. Most popular translation of it is I am. In English, it's I am. And when Moses asks God to say his name, for all intents and purposes, he just says I am with a relative pronoun and I am again. Which sometimes we translate it, I am who I am. That's really helpful. It's called to be translated, I caused to be what I caused to be. And if you're a slave and your life is crap, also not a great name, kind of a little bit harsh. It can also mean I will be what I will be, or I am what I was. Some even say it's a pun, play on words. And it was funny back in the ancient Near East, they were like, this was, you know, bust in the gut over this one, and we're like, yeah, we don't know it anymore. And scholars have debated the translation for years. Since the story was first recorded in the end, we don't really know. We don't know what it means. But it's the name of God, right? Moses asks, what's your name? God says, this is my name. And for those in the Christian community who believe that God inspired this word usage, that's troubling. What could God be trying to communicate through the name given? And wouldn't that be important to know? And thus for many years, thousands, and I'm telling you thousands and thousands and thousands of pages have been written on this topic to try and figure out what does it mean? Luckily, Friends Church View, we don't have to wrestle with that as much. But there's no clear consensus. And the truth is, we just don't know what it means. We don't know what the name of God means. So we've named it the Tetragrammaton. That's a good word, huh? Tetragrammaton, tetra, four. Grammaton is from the Greek grammatic, so it means four letters. Sounds better to say tetragrammaton than four letters, right? Because if you look, it's four letters, see? In fact, and this is a little biblical Hebrew for you guys, in Hebrew, they only write down the consonants. So with what you're seeing over there, the letters you're seeing are only consonants. The vowels are kind of assumed. But if you add different vowels to the same group of consonants, you get different words. So with the same tetragrammaton, depending on what vowels you add to these letters, the pronunciation changes. Have anyone heard the word or the name Jehovah? That's a German pronunciation of a particular vowel set with those four letters. Yahweh, anyone heard that name? More common one, right? That's the one we do now. Again, same four letters, different vowel sets. So we don't actually know what it means. We don't know how to say it. So what exactly do we do with that? There's this big moment, you know, God, what's your name? Here's my name. Boom. That's not very helpful. Thank you. And I think the thing I want you to remember today is I don't think the name's about some mystical meaning, something we kind of understand underneath these four letters and it, you know, elucidates this massive thing about God. I don't think that's the purpose. I want to focus today on how God sharing the tetragrammaton functions in the story. When does God share the name? With whom does God share the name? I think that's where we get the most impacting reading of this story. So we go back to the Moses story. He feels like a traitor to his people. And he didn't even do anything. It's just, it's what, you know, his lot in life. Egyptians hate him. The Israelites hate him. And God calls him back to go to Pharaoh to help emancipate the Israelites. Go to the people who hate him in order to save the people who also hate him. Did God make a mistake? Doesn't it seem like there would be someone better qualified for this? Why did God put that on Moses' list? A man uniquely suited not to be able to accomplish the task. I'm guessing most likely we've felt some of those feelings too. Maybe not to the degree Moses did. But we've been there, right? Feeling the sense of God's kind of pushing you in a direction. Or maybe it's more overt, putting something on your list. And it seems like the only way that that thing on your list makes sense is if God made a mistake. Because you are the last person who should be focusing on this. I have a friend who's called to international relief work. but struggles with debilitating mental illness. Feels called by God to go do international relief work. A friend of mine is called by God, but for them, their addiction gets in the way. Why would God call somebody who can't actually do the thing that they're being called to do? Sometimes it's because we're men or women, old, young, healthy, unhealthy, skilled newbies. Over and over again, we have these moments where God, we feel God going that direction. And you look at the person next to you and say, doesn't it make more sense for them to do it? Because I'm not the right person. And that's where this reading of Moses, it becomes interesting, isn't it? Standing before God, thinking the thoughts we're thinking, I don't think I'm the right guy for this job. I think you should call somebody else. And the answer that God gives him, the tetragrammaton, the name of God, I am. But I think it isn't just a name. It's not just the word I am. I think it's an idea, a view of God that really says to Moses, I am choosing you. I know you. I know what people think about you. And I am choosing you. Imagine Moses' reaction. Really? You think I'm the right guy for this? I don't know where you are in your life. I don't know where you feel God is moving you, what God's calling you to do. But I'm guessing there's times when you're thinking, I am not the right person. I'm not worthy of this. Surely there's got to be someone better out there. Jeff shared his story last week about feeling like he didn't have what it takes to do what God asked. And Moses doesn't feel like he has what it takes. Moses doesn't feel like he's the right person. I'm guessing that for each and every one of us, there's these times when we just go, I don't think I'm the right guy. I think that's where the name of God comes alive. Because when we stand in Moses' shoes, when we put ourselves into the story, asking God, why me? I'm not the right person. This can't be me. We can hear the voice of God through the story of Moses saying, I choose you. You're exactly the right person for this. I want you here. I think that's what the name of God, the tetragrammaton, means. The God of our Bible, the God of our spiritual ancestors, that God is asking each one of us to play a role in this world. And that God is saying, I choose you. There's another part of the tetragrammaton that, in order to understand, I need to tell you the story of kind of from a different angle. This one I want you to focus on, not on Moses this time, but on Moses' people, the Israelites. So without seeing it through their lens, I think you lose part of the story. So I need you to think like a slave. Okay. He just raised his eyebrow at me like, huh? So I know it's not something you're familiar with. So picture this. There's no such thing as an 8-hour workday. We're talking 12, 16-hour days. And there's no such thing as a 5-hour or 5-day work week. Every day you work. There's no such thing as labor standards. If someone didn't like you or what you did or the color of the hair or where you looked, they could do whatever they wanted to you. Most likely you're beaten. Not often killed, because if you're killed, you can't work, right? But they could make your life a living hell. And this isn't a one person working and bringing home the bacon for the family. No, everyone works. Men, women, older children. If you're old enough to walk, you could do something, right? The conditions are just enough to keep you alive. You lift and carry as much as you can all day, every day. You do the things that are too disgusting for anybody else to do. And that's your job. You did what someone told you to do when they told you to do it, as often as they told you to do it. And if you did anything wrong, if you didn't do it fast enough, if you did anything in a way that caused them displeasure, most likely you're beaten with fists, clubs, whips. You have no worth other than what you can do for another, for only as long as they wanted you to do it. Your mind wasn't yours. Your body wasn't yours. You lived and died at another whim. Beaten, raped, humiliated. If you were killed, your owner just needed to want to kill you. You were property. You were the same as a dog or a sheep. Even more disturbing is your children are property. In fact, all around you, all of your neighbors have recently had their babies taken from them by the owner. Taken. Never coming back. Many scholars think that this story was first written down many hundreds of years after the approximate time in which it was set. So remember, Jeff talked about this the first week. We're taking this as the genre of historical theology, which means this is a story about people's views about God set in a particular historical milieu. It may or may not have happened. It may or may not have happened like it says it happened. But that's not important. These are statements about God. So it's important to think why the redactors, the people who put these stories together, put these stories together. And yes, if you read the text, there's very little doubt that the Exodus story that we have is made up of a number of stories, all of them a little bit different. There are numerous repetitions with slight changes. There's some stuff where it's like, and then this was going to happen, and it doesn't happen. There's other stuff where it's like, okay, when this happens, then we're going to move forward. That never actually happens. And a redactor takes stories, removes parts of one story, takes the parts off this story, and then puts them together. And that's basically the Exodus story. A whole bunch of stories kind of mashed together. Sometimes well done. Other times I'm thinking, what were you guys thinking? Did you read this before you published it? So why did the redactor take these particular stories and put them together in this particular way? And the answer lies for many scholars in what happened a number of years later. Because in about 740 BC, the Assyrian Empire invaded and captured much of the Israelite nation. So, the Egyptian story is set earlier than that. This is a number of hundreds of years later. And the guy at the head of the Assyrian Empire was named Tiglath-Pileser. That's a good name, huh? Tiglath, how's it going? Actually, Tiglath-Pileser was his first name. He had all sorts of other names, but... And his wife had an even crazier name. One of my profs named his dog after the wife. This is geeky theology humor. So Tiglath-Pileser and his army capture the northern part of Israel and take them into captivity, making them slaves again. Sounds familiar, huh? And the last piece of the puzzle you need to understand is that this time the Israelites' model of God, if bad things happen to you, it's because God's mad at you. So if you apply for a job and you get it, God's happy with you. If you apply for a job and don't get it, God's mad. Fields are good, happy. Fields are bad, mad. Children, happy. No children, mad. They looked at their life and anything that went good, that's because God likes us. Anything that goes bad, God doesn't like us. So we're slaves in a country. What does that say about how God feels about us? They look at themselves and go, God has left us. And not in a funny kind of jokey, like, you know, you know, don't get the job, God's angry. This is fundamentally at their core. God hates us. God has left us. In their minds, with everything going on around them, God wants nothing to do with them. And that's when some scholars say the story of captivity in Egypt was first written down. Because remember, imagine it. Being a slave, owned, beaten, abused. Can't fathom anything more. You're hopeless. And that means God hates you. He's left you. He doesn't even care what you're going through. And just picture that in your own life for a second. I know we don't have slavery and all of our problems are first world problems. But all of us at some point in our life, either now or in the past or in the future, have had bad things happen. Death, pain, loss, sorrow. Sometimes it's similar things. We're not happy at work or at home or with our lives or with where our lives got to. We're not proud of what we've done or who we are. It seems as more and more of these feelings inside of us rise to the surface, it's almost like they get in the way of God. We often talk about people coming after the proverbial crap has hit the fan. That's when they find religion. They want to come to church again. In the middle of it, I think there's a separation from God. It's not theological like the Israelites, but we seem to do it, don't we? We feel this disconnection from God. We feel like if we looked up and looked for God in this moment, we wouldn't find God. And I think God has given up on us. God's left us. In the same way the Israelites in captivity under Tiglath-Pileser would have felt, where is God? He's left. He's angry at us. And so when the Israelites subjected by Tiglath-Pileser heard the story of Moses and slaves, I think it blew their minds. And I think when we look at it through our feelings of disconnection from God, I think it can do things for us too. I think that's why the Israelite story in captivity under Tiglath-Pileser, when they heard about Moses, this thing went viral for them. They think God's angry at them. So you're trudging home after a long, hot, painful day. You're exhausted, your head's hanging low from fatigue. Your feet are dragging. And your fellow slave next to you says, hey, you want to hear a story? Sure. What do you got? You hear the story about our ancestors? And God not being mad at them? As the story starts like this. The story of a man named Moses who's walking down the street one day when he sees a bush that's on fire, but it's not being burned up. And he goes to the bush and God calls out to him. And after Moses battles with shame that Jeff talks about, God says this, I've certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers. Yes, I'm aware of their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and to lead them out of Egypt into their own fertile and spacious land. Remember how story functioned with me and my counselor? Suddenly their story became my story. I think the slaves under Tiglath-Pileser who heard of this Moses story would have heard God saying something like this. I have certainly seen your oppression. I've heard your cries of distress because of your harsh slave drivers. Yes, I'm aware of your suffering. So I've come down to rescue you from the people that are hurting you, and I'll bring you to your own land. In a word, I know what you're going through. I know this life of slavery and shame and hurt and betrayal and pain. I know it. I think when the slaves heard the rest of the story, how Moses asked for God's name in order to prove that God was talking, when they heard the name of God, when they heard the Tetragrammaton, the I Am statement, I can't help but think what the Israelite slaves heard. And what I want you guys to hear today is God saying, I am not leaving you. I'm with you. I'm beside you. You're not alone. I know I feel distant. And I know you feel like I don't care and that I don't love you, but I am not leaving you. Just like my counselor's stories, the story of God being with the people of Israel as slaves in Egypt, I think would have had an amazing story of hope for the people enslaved under Tiglath-Pileser. Maybe God does care about us. Maybe God is here with us, isn't mad at us. And think of the same thing can create a moment of hope for you, for me. You think I'm an addict. Hear God saying, I'm not leaving you. You think we're bums or losers. I'm not leaving you. We're fat or unlovable or whatever. I am not leaving you. The words of the author of the story in Exodus, God says, I am not leaving you. And today, I want to encourage you to go out and try this new belief about God on. For some of you, maybe you already believe it. I don't know. But try it on. What if today you remember the Tetragrammaton, the four letters, and you remember the name of God, not as some mystical phrase that gives you deeper meaning into God's mind and how God works, but rather as a statement of God with us. I am choosing you. And more importantly, the belief that God says, I am not leaving you. You're not alone. Today I want you to try that on. Would you? When you have moments of shame and frustration, of hurt and sorrow, I am not leaving you. When you have moments of conflict and hurt and pain, you feel like everything is against you, I am not leaving you. When you have a moment where God calls you to do something and you just go, that cannot be for me. I am not that person. Hear that voice. I am choosing you. When you feel like you're unworthy, I am choosing you. Would you try it on this week? Standing in the grocery store lineup? Next job interview? Alone at night or in the middle of a crowd? How would it change you if you believed that statement? If you believe that God has called you, it wasn't a mistake. You're exactly good enough to be here. How would that change how you live? So here's my homework for you. Try it on. I don't know if it'll fit for you, but it just might change a lot of things in your life. It just might become a new model of God for you. That's not a bad thing. So, have a great weekend, everyone.